He's right in front of me, and I can honestly tell him that I'm going to knock him spark out. Leaping right hand by the Prince. Ooh. And a hard left. And Kelly's down for the third time.
Whoa! He's for real. The
unbelievable.
For real.
One more touch. And Tardivan's gone. Bernadon is the champion of the world. Bernadon is the champion of the world. Fantastic, Bernard. Fantastic.
And here comes
welcome along to Off the Brawl on Off the Ball. I'm Ronan Mullen, joined as always by Phil Egan and Simon Maguire. No Andy Lee this week. He's on location filming some Game of Thrones stuff.
Yeah, is he?
Could the man be any more excited about this whole endeavour?
Well, he said last week his mastermind, some special category would either be boxing or Game of Thrones, so I think that kind of sums up where he's at with it.
Is he more of a super fan than you?
I think he is. He's read the books. I'm not up to speed in the books.
Phil, you're not. Not way inclined at all.
No, but I am.
What's your favourite show?
I don't really watch.
Bullseye.
I was watching it last week, actually, like the classic Bullseye with Jim Bowen, and it was so old that even Bully's special prize board was different, like, than the one that kind of evolved. But prizes were still terrible. The lads missed out on the speedboat. And there was a bow around it as well.
I remember spending summer holidays at school watching Challenge, like these game shows from like 1993.
Yeah, it's like Bullseye was class.
Different ball game.
Yeah, like it was Sunday evening, just after the big match on ITV.
What was the Les Dennis show?
Family Fortune.
Oh, that was excellent.
That was a good one. They do remakes, but they're never as good.
On to boxing now. We have a brilliant weekend of action this week. Doubleheader in America. We've got actually one of them's in Mexico, but that's a touchy subject over there. We've got Jaime Munguia against Dennis Hogan, and before that, we've got Anthony Crawley against Lomachenko. We actually have an interview with Dennis Hogan coming up later on the show, and we've spoken to Anthony Crawley on the show before. Both friends of the show, as it were, but they won't mind me saying that they're both big underdogs this weekend. And it's just called to mind is something we've been discussing in the office. Underdog performances or biggest upsets, rather, in your experiences of boxing. Like, we could go all the way back to early 20th century, but none of us actually saw those. But in terms of your own boxing experiences, Phil, what would you say is up there?
One that springs to mind is obviously Rackman beating Lennox Lewis. It was on BBC. BBC made a big deal about the fact that this was a heavyweight title fight on BBC, and it was in South Africa. And I can remember getting up to watch it, because it wasn't like a Sky card, which could start at 1 in the morning. I remember getting up to watch it and, knocked out. And I've heard Lennox Lewis talking about it. Like, he said when the right hand was coming towards him, you know, he thought he had his left hand high enough up to block it. And there was so much around the fight that he was out filming in Las Vegas doing Ocean's 11, and there's that famous commentary line from Larry Merchant that he's just drowned in Ocean's 11 after getting knocked out. He won the rematch, Lewis. Like, he was a much better boxer. But just, I remember at the time, like, that was always the thing with heavyweight boxing. One punch can change everything. And we'd seen it before with Lewis, with Oliver McCall, that he was susceptible to that big shot. But, just one of those, you're watching it and you're in disbelief. And I was also thinking as well, Tyson Holyfield, the first one. Like, Holyfield had lost to Michael Moore a few years beforehand, had retired. He had heart issues after that fight. And nobody gave him a chance, really, going into the Tyson fight. And Tyson was all over him at the start. And eventually, just to see Holyfield, like, coming through it and then putting him down. And obviously we know what happened in the rematch. So I thought that was a big shock as well, but not as big as Rackman beating Lewis.
Mm. And if you're playing Off the Brawl bingo at home, another Teddy Atlas mentioned here, he was speaking about that Holyfield-Tyson fight. And if you go through Tyson's record, you know, he just didn't have the heart once he was, like, pushed on a psychological level in a fight. He was never able to match the top-level opponents, and Holyfield was the perfect example of that.
How could I mention Tyson without Buster Douglas? That's probably the biggest of them all.
Yeah.
And that was different, where I was young enough to know the fight was on, but I couldn't get to see it because I was probably 9 or 10, and it was a case of, I don't know where I can watch it, but I remember my dad telling me Tyson was beaten, and that was a big shock.
And often the intrigue around boxing is something that's levelled against it, the whole shady stuff behind the scenes, but that's almost the most interesting part of it. And the stuff with Buster Douglas was never the same afterwards. He couldn't really handle the pressure, and Holyfield beat him quite handily. And then Rackman, as you mentioned, was offered a big deal by HBO after that fight and turned it down, lost the rematch, and hasn't really been heard from since. Same with Oliver McCall. That's one thing you have to credit Lennox Lewis in terms of putting him in the pantheon of great heavyweights. Anyone who beat him, he came back and squared
the rematch with McCall was bizarre. Like, when McCall broke down in the ring.
Yeah.
I remember, like, at the time, when I got that in as pay-per-view, and that was hard-earned money, you know. I think I was stacking shelves in a supermarket, so I would have forked out. I was like, McCall broke down in the ring. I was just like, what are you doing? Mm. You know, you've beaten this guy before, like, knock him out again.
Yeah.
Lewis should have rematched with Hadi Klitschko, though, just as an asterisk on that one.
I think he sort of thought he took one too fight too many, and if he fought Klitschko again, he'd probably lose, so I might give him a pass on that, but that was a hell of a fight while it lasted.
I'm not giving him a pass on that. He should have rematched Vitaly Klitschko.
Oh, Vitaly was a bit of a monster. So in terms of your own upsets, Simon, what are you thinking?
Well, I knew it was going to happen, but the Brightest Prescott, Amir Khan, knockout. I mean, Khan had been dropped by Willie Lyman and Michael Gomez in his, you know, kind of build them up fights, and then they put him in against this puncher. I think Prescott at the time was 18 wins with 17 knockouts, and he just went in and absolutely obliterated him. And I think the fact that Khan actually managed to come back and have such a successful career after that upset is one of the more remarkable things about his career. But that, as an upset, I think that was huge. I think Sky had put so much into building Khan up. And
box office. That was his box office debut.
And he got absolutely starched. But then again, to see how he's come along, and now he's up against Bud Crawford again, what, maybe 10, 12 years later, is a remarkable turnaround. Another one, again, another English fighter, was actually when he was fighting Michael Katsidis, when Kevin Mitchell fought at Upton Park. And again, you know, Katsidis was seen as the steely vet, but we'll get him in there, get him a name, and get Mitchell can move on. And Katsidis went in and pretty much beat him up in front of his home crowd. I think another one that kind of maybe gets glossed over was the Arturo Gatti-Mickey Ward first fight. I think Arturo Gatti was a huge favourite for that. And Ward dragged him into a slugfest. And the great thing about that then was the trilogy which came from it, and then the friendship between the two fighters afterwards. But I think that first fight, Ward didn't have a chance at all.
Mm. And the Prescott one is kind of a standard example of poor matchmaking. And Andy spoke about it last week or the week before, where there's very few good matchmakers left in boxing. And the way Amir Khan, as Simon said, had been knocked down in previous fights and then was matched against one of the biggest punchers in the division, the logic there left a lot to be desired, didn't it?
Yeah, it was just so spectacular as well. It wasn't like a stoppage late on, it was early. And, you know, as I said, to make your Sky box office debut and to be humiliated like that, you know, he's coming up against Crawford in a few weeks, and he splits opinions, Amir Khan, but you look at his record, you look at the guys that he's fought, he's beaten some, he's lost to some, but he's always fought the best. He's never shied away from a challenge. Like, Kell Brook might have a different opinion of that, but, you know, I've always felt with that potential match that Kell Brook needs Amir Khan more than Amir Khan needs Kell Brook.
Mm. A fight we said we'd never talk about again after January, if I remember correctly.
Well, look, when he loses to Crawford, we'll be talking about it in a few weeks anyway, so why not?
Another one, actually, Kelly Pavlik, when he was a middleweight champ going in against Bernard Hopkins, everyone was like, I think they wanted to set Pavlik up with Calzaghe. And I remember Pavlik at the press thing when they announced the Hopkins fight, he goes, we have to shoot Calzaghe in the leg to stop him from running. And Hopkins was the only fight we could get to make a buck. And then Hopkins absolutely schooled him.
Yeah, no, it's true. And Hopkins has a few of those, like Felix Trinidad springs to mind. There's obviously countless, and we'd appreciate your suggestions as well if you want to get us on the hashtag Off the Broad. But one that kind of had all the ingredients was Ricky Hatton against Costa Zhu, because granted Costa Zhu was coming towards the end of his career, but he was still a pound for pound fighter at that stage. And Hatton had the style was all wrong in theory for Hatton, like a brawler against a supreme boxer. And it just turned out so well because he beat him conclusively in the end to retire on the stool. And it springboarded Hatton into the money-making phase of his career, the phase of his career for which he's really remembered in America. So,
well, that fight was
put on.
And
the commentary for me in Dark is one of the more memorable sound bites of recent times as well.
Actually, it was on recent enough. Like, you kind of get these fights, they show them back on Sky sometimes. Like, and I was watching it back recently, and yeah, he just, after a few rounds, you could see, like, his work rate was just too much for Costa Zoo. But that was that started at what, 2 a.m. That was tailored for the US audience.
Yeah, it was on Showtime.
Yeah, and it was brilliant. Like, and just the crowd, and yeah, because you think of some of the fights that have been on in the UK where they put them on in the early hours of the morning, which is just, you know, you think of the build up to those fights if you're a fan going to them. Like, can you last the pace yourself, like, to go and stay up even to watch these fights? It just makes for an unbelievable atmosphere.
Yeah. And you mentioned this catered for the American audience, and the most obvious example of that is the Jeff Lacy against Joe Calzaghe. If you were living in America, there was only one winner in that fight, but over here you knew how good Joe Calzaghe was, and Jeff Lacy was pedestaled as the next Roy Jones, and Calzaghe just took him to school, didn't he?
Ah, he absolutely outboxed him, and Lacy never recovered. Like, just an absolute boxing lesson. And that one was on ITV, so it's one of those where you could stay up and watch it. And, like, I was always a Calzaghe fan. I remember seeing him early doors when he was on Sky, and obviously he had the fight with Eubank. But yeah, he was, and that kind of, again, kind of similar to Hatton, the US audience saw him and they thought, this lad's unbelievable. And then he started traveling, and he went up a weight as well, and he got those big fights, and ended up undefeated. But that's his standout performance, even though his win against Kessler was so impressive as well. I know he beat Roy Jones and Hopkins. Like, I thought the Hopkins fight was really close. Like, if you watch it a few times, you could give it to either fighter.
As I said, there's probably too many to mention today, but
Klitschko and Tyson Fury, is that
in the bookies, I suppose? And looking back, it probably doesn't seem as much of an upset when you've seen how good Tyson Fury is.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was such a big step up.
And where it was as well, going to Germany and all the antics around. You remember before the fight, it looked like Furies were going to pull out of the like on the night of the fight, saying, nah, we're done with this, they're trying to screw us here.
To win on points in Germany, it just shows how conclusive the win was.
Yeah, I think so. Was it Felix Sturm and Oscar De La Hoya? And it was the first time Sturm left Germany, and he got...
Probably should have won.
Got stiffed in the cars in that fight as well, so...
Yeah, you don't feel too sorry for Felix Sturm. Got a nice...
He's been on the right side of a view.
Against Macklin, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just watching that Groves documentary, it's funny how Sturm eventually sort of set up a world title win for a British fighter when he beat Shudinov and then had to vacate the title. Shudinov fought Groves and the rest is history, so... It's funny how things turn out.
One from yourself, Ron. Upset.
Well, Hatton too is probably up there. Apart from that, like, going into the amateur ranks, I think Michael Conlon losing in 2016, have it coming off the gold medal win at the World Championships was pretty startling. Yeah, but you know what I mean, like.
Sure, we can go through dodgy decisions. We can have a whole dodgy decision segment. But, like, he didn't lose that.
Robberies. We'll do robberies next week.
And now for the liars.
Yeah.
Any last honourable mentions from you, Simon?
Maybe the Jeff Horn upset against Manny Pacquiao in Brisbane. And that was a very close fight, and it could have gone either way.
Questionable decision.
But going into it, yeah, no, nobody gave Jeff Horn a shout.
Just going to run through some of the suggestions from the listeners. Tony Doyle comes in with saying that being at the stadium when Phil Sutcliffe knocked out John Joe Joyce at the 08 Olympics was my favourite fight ever at the stadium. Yeah. That's a memorable one. Buster Douglas against Mike Tyson. Douglas didn't seem possible at the time.
42-1.
Yeah. Hassan Rahman gets an honourable mention here as well. Martin Wall actually got in touch saying getting knocked out by a journeyman in the first round of my second pro fight, that was an upset in itself. So it's a bit ironic that these things can happen. Leonard Gunning got back to him and said, sack the matchmaker. So Leonard actually says himself, domestically, Kiko against Bernard Dunn.
Yeah.
Something we mentioned as well.
Yeah, but again, when you think of what happened afterwards, maybe it wasn't such a shock. But on the night, yeah, like everyone turned up expecting Bernard Dunne to win.
And then one of my favourite upsets he mentions here, Martin Rogan against Audley Harrison.
Ah, yeah. I remember watching that with my
Unbelievable.
Dad.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Broke his jaw, didn't he?
Yeah. That was a really good fight.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. Like, he grew into it. Audley Harrison, my God. I went to see Audley Harrison fight Danny Williams because...
You lost a bet?
No. Kevin McBride was meant to be on it. He was meant to be on the card against Matt Skelton at the XL Arena. And we'd booked, a load of us had booked over to go because McBride had just beaten Tyson. He said, let's go and, you know, honour the man and let's go and watch him in London. And it got pulled. So it was Danny Williams and Audley Harrison. It was a dreadful fight. Amir Khan actually was on the undercard, which was it was good to see him.
Mm.
But, yeah, Audley Harrison was just so frustrating.
Getting depressed just thinking about it, actually.
Yeah.
And Barry on Twitter came in with Michael Collins' exit from the 2016 Olympics. He clearly won the fight, but for reasons we all know, he wasn't given the win, which pretty much alludes to what you were saying, Simon. Yeah.
He'll get his revenge in the pro ranks, though.
Are we excited for that fight?
Ah, yeah. Just, it's closure, like.
Yeah.
It won't be much of a fight.
I think Nick Eaton's showings in the pro ranks so far would suggest he's probably not all that.
Well, his showings in the amateur ranks suggested it as well.
As was clear at the time, yeah. Although a couple of medals as an amateur, he didn't do too badly. We're going to get to that interview with Dennis Hogan in a second, but just some Irish news from elsewhere. David Oliver Joyce picked up the WBO European title in Dubai, which brought about one of my favourite images from the weekend.
Yeah, you'd appreciate this.
Naz looking well, Phil?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Healthy, I'd say, Simon.
That him on the right, is it?
He actually, it was the anniversary of his own sort of quasi-upset when he lost to Barrera, which can't really be classified as an upset because Barrera's a Hall of Famer, but at the time he seemed sort of invincible. I don't know if it was just the air of
the cult happens,
of
though.
Prince.
But that's what happens with all these fighters that are doing so well in the UK, like they have their world title fights, they get built up and then they come up against somebody and they think this is incredible, they lost. But then, like you said, Barrera.
One of the all-time greats. Like.
Yeah.
One of the memorable things about the post-fight interview is how humble he was, because everyone just presumed when he lost he'd just storm out of the ring, but in retrospect it was kind of the defining moment in his career, because he was never the same after that.
No.
Just moving on to some other Irish stuff, mentioned for Stevie McKenna, who got a win, joined his brother in blazing the trail in the pro ranks. They're both doing really well and have some famous sparring partners as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's on TV. Stoppage win. Good start. Move on. Didn't take any damage.
Be cool to see them headlining a show together at some stage, wouldn't it?
Tag team kind of thing. No, it was... Like, you could tell how excited he was to... He's been looking at his brother, getting so many fights under his belt, and it was great for him to get the stoppage as well. And he said that after the fight. He was like, I just wanted to show not only am I a good boxer, but I can get these lads out early. So we'll get to see how good a boxer he is over the next few months and years.
Yeah, and one last bit of news, the Celtic Clash, which has been announced this week for the 25th of May at the Devonish in Belfast, which of course hosted the first ever Celtic Clash back in 2013. Joe Fitzpatrick and Stephen Webb will headline that one, but there's a really nice undercard there. Jake Haney returns. Like, it's good to see him active again, putting some fights together. Sean McDinchy's there, Conor Cook, and there's a few debuts as well. Dominic Dunnigan, Conor Doherty, and Jamie Douglas. So that's another big... And in fairness to Belfast, in the years when Irish boxing has sort of been fighting for relevancy, Belfast has always been like churning out these really competitive cards, so it's good to see more of them.
Yeah, and as Leonard said, he wants to build up the pro base, and Jake Haney's back in action about 2 months after. So, yeah, no, he's a man of his word.
Mm. And speaking of Irish boxing, there's no bigger Irish story this week than Dennis Hogan, who faces the quite fearsome challenge of Jaime Munguia in Mexico on Saturday night. Delighted to say I caught up with Dennis last week and I asked him how preparations have gone for the biggest test of his career.
Preparations have gone really well. I will say though, the climate here is actually a bit fresher than Australia.
Oh, really?
In Australia Brisbane was 37, 38 degrees before we headed off, so that was quite intense training in that heat, but we've gotten here now and it's a lot cooler, so it's been good now to up the intensity a little bit more. As it's cooler, it's more refreshing, We're good to go. So it's perfectly in line with what we're looking to do and how we're looking to perform on April 30.
Great stuff. And I saw a picture of yourself and Shane Mosley. What was that like?
Yeah, cool. Shane's a cool guy. He was in there doing a bit of a promotion as well. But it turned out we had we got a guy here for a massage. We heard him done some good athletes, and that's we got him in. And he had made the connection as well. So he's massaged Shane Mosley for years. So that's how we made the connection. And then Shane came into the gym and was in a bit of promotion there as well. So it was cool. A very nice guy, and he's going. It was cool to finally meet him too.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the fight is booked in for April 13th, huge fight against Jaime Munguia. It was announced quite recently, Dennis, but did that affect your prep at all, or were you already in camp knowing that this was likely going to be around this time?
Yeah, look, we had chatted in the gym and we had said, obviously I keep saying it anyway, but we did say that worst case scenario and how everything would go, April 13th would be the date, so I was keeping fit as I usually do, but I was just making sure I was ticking all the boxes in time off camp. So once we got the call, it was 6.5 weeks out, it got signed. So I was like, okay, it's time to ramp up the intensity now, which I did well. So obviously it was a quick jump, so there was a little bit of extra recovery and stuff needed to be done as it was a quick jump. But at the same time, I've done it really well now. My body's in great shape. It's battle hardened and ready for the last week's camp next week and then the fight the week after.
Yeah, and the fight takes place on Munguia's home turf. I know you and your team had some reservations about maybe fighting in Mexico initially. Were the terms just too good to turn down in the end?
Well, the way I am is I go into every fight with a belief. And so before that, you try to get all the little things in your corner, all the little 1%. But whenever you make a decision about the fight, then you just turn your focus towards winning. And I have a certainty that I can go over there and lift the title. So, once the decision was made, it was all good. It wasn't really about the terms were so good. It was just about what works and what can we do with it. So that was just seemed to be the best way to go about it as well. So. My team did very well, and I'm doing well in training to get the win. So it's all good either way.
Yeah, and it should be a brilliant occasion. We might get into the fight itself shortly, Dennis, but I just want to go back to your initial beginnings in boxing. I know your grandfather was a big influence. Can you just tell me a bit about how you first got involved in the sport?
My grandfather, Paddy Buck, was the local boxing coach in Nairn's Boxing Club and brought me along from a very young age. I did have my first underage fight at 8 years of age, which I remember because it's an art. But, and then my first competitive fight at 11 years of age, which was in the league down at Cullen Boxing Hall. That happens every year. It used to happen every year. So, it's been a long time for me. I don't remember life without boxing, but after my grandfather stopped training, I then went to Grange Con Boxing Club where I was for about 13 years under Shavey Byrne and the boys up there boxing with Ross Hickey and that. So I've had some good years and I've been around some very good athletes throughout that time. I boxed not only obviously with Ross a lot, but boxing on the Irish boxing team, and I have some great pictures I have of lining up the box for Ireland with Katie Taylor, Eric Donovan, Roy Sheen, all the old boys there that used to be, and lads and ladies that used to box well for Ireland and stuff. So very very good memories for me. But here is where it's at now in the pro game for me. So I've put everything into the last 8 years, and ready to lift that title now.
Yeah, and you obviously came into a bit of a golden age of Irish boxing, no more so than Kenny Egan, who was in your division at the time. You would have fought him a couple of times, Dennis. What were those fights like?
I probably should have mentioned that one too. But it was a transition for me. I had just won the Irish Intermediate, so seniors as it's known now. And so my first fight as an elite, which turned to 3 3-minute rounds instead of 4 2s, was against Kenny. Kenny just came back from a silver medal in the Olympics. So it was a funny one to draw him first up. But No, he was very good. He was very strategic. You know, I love to get in and fire shots and stuff, and obviously him being a big tall southpaw, big range tall southpaw, it was tough. But at that time, I think Kenny just, I think he was, he's just really good at picking his shots and getting out, you know, and even though I would have felt like I would have landed a few more than the judges would have said, like, you know, he won the bout. There was a close one, which I did like, in and around the World Championships, but, you know, I couldn't complain about any decisions, and he was a great fighter, especially being a rangy southpaw the way he was. He was really good at what he did. So, but they were great experience for me. You know, I used to actually not like southpaws, but now I've actually, it doesn't matter if it's a southpaw or an orthodox for me. So it's obviously been some great experience for me back those days, those fights.
Yeah, and you said there he obviously came back with the medal from the Olympics, and he's from Brannockstown, which wouldn't be too far from your own neck of the woods. Was he in some ways, was he a little bit of an inspiration for you that you could achieve sort of similar things, knowing you were mixing it with him at the top level?
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah. I mean, going into that fight, first up, I remember having a feeling going, whoa, this is the top of the elite level here that I'm going to be boxing, you know, for the first time. And then after the fight, then, you know, obviously I was disappointed. I remember the feeling because I hadn't lost for a long time. But I remember at the same time thinking, you know, I can get to that level now. I mean, once you're able to gauge something and see where you are and how far you got to go, then it actually inspired me to think, right, well, this is what I need to do. And maybe all the good choices I made as a pro, that might have helped that decision, you know, knowing where the elite level is and where I got to get to. I think making a lot of good life choices and health choices that I did do, when it came down to, you know, some of those fights too. So, definitely very beneficial.
Yeah, and you eventually relocated to Australia, Dennis, and it would have been around the time of the recession, so I'm sure that played into it a bit. There were some frustrations boxing-wise as well. Can you just tell me a bit about your thought process behind making that move?
Yeah, well, so we've been on a team. I think it was an Irish team select out in Australia, I had boxed well out there. I'd beaten the champion in Brisbane, where I live now, but obviously, I was told it was a pro am show, and the pro promoter said, if you want to come back out here and have a couple of fights, you're more than welcome. So, you know, I thought it was cool, but I didn't really. I went back to Ireland and narrowed in on winning an Irish elite title. And after 2 years, that didn't happen. I just went, you know, I just thought, you know, it might be a little bit hard to get over. You know, you've got Kenny Egan sitting at the top there, and Michael Ward coming through. Now that fight with Michael Ward didn't happen until afterwards, but I had sparred Michael, and I did think, you know, he was good. But I've got to make the decision that I want to try and get there, you know, get to that level in that very short amount of time, or would I go pro and start out my journey and go from there and build up the way I really wanted to do it. So I mean, then I remember, you know. Well, I decided I would go professional then, and then obviously there was no shows in the Republic of Ireland for a long time, so I hit up that offer and I came back to Australia and started having some pro fights. I had 9 pro fights in my first year out as a pro, so you know, that'll tell you how good it was out there, and you know, obviously how good it was for my career. And then obviously with that came other things, came sponsorship, and just came me getting into a groove, which I never really, the one thing about me in my life, I never really got a groove in boxing. Like, I could have good stints and bad stints, and then not training and not training to my potential, but this time I just focused in and just went laser focused, which I have for the past 8 years. So it's been great in terms of that, and it's been one of the best choices I've ever made.
Yeah, and I'm sure Australia, it's a bit of a switch up from life in Kildare. Did it take you long to acclimatise to the different weather and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I remember the first summer there, you know, not even when you're training, but I remember training too, it was crazy. I just couldn't believe how hot it would get, because not only would it be hot, but your core temperature would rise too with training, and just how hard it was for the first, I got there in summer, so how hard it was for the first while. But then as winter came in, winter came in, which is like summer in Ireland. And then by the time summer came back again, I was a lot more used to it. And so I did take a year to acclimatise to that craziness. But when you get those hot days like I did last week and the week before, 37, 38 degrees, high humidity, I'll never, ever feel used to that. I don't know if anyone really does. Like, I look at the Aussies and they'd be boxing in it. They don't complain about it mostly. And I'm like, you know, I'd be complaining about it. Like, I'd be asking them questions. Like, I'd be wanting to see, you know, are you okay with this heat? But to be honest with you, when you get in there and you go hard, like, it's after two or three rounds, you're already feeling it. Like, you're feeling it bad. So you got to stay on your hydration and everything else. And then, but when you get to the end of it and you get through all the work, that's when you know you're ready to go and fight in a normal temperature arena, whatever it may be. So, I mean, that heat is pretty intense, but I think of it now as conditioning. So.
Yeah, and you mentioned you've been pro for 8 years. It's actually 8 years this weekend since your first fight against Marlon Tobey. What are your memories of that first fight and the differences between the amateur gloves and the pro gloves and all that kind of stuff, the different environment?
Yeah, crazy. Like, I remember obviously gloving up for the fight and it was what it was. I got in and I remember I threw the first, whatever I threw, but when I remember I threw the first hook, I remember feeling his ear squash against his head. And I just kind of, Jesus, these tall gloves, like, this is just like a street fight. And then I started landing some good shots, and I could just feel his forehead, I could feel the bones in his face against my knuckles, and I was like, well, this is crazy. And then when I dropped him, then I just went, after, like, obviously that all the rest of it came fast, and I got the win. But I remember thinking after, like, this is actually just like a street fight. That's how I feel on my body. That's how I felt. Like, obviously with no headgear too, for the first time, when I left amateur, there was headgear, and I remember, you know, a couple of little headbangs and a couple of little bumps on the head and stuff, and it just felt like street fight to me. So I was like, well, we got to get better for the next fight because, you know, it's pretty dangerous in there. So that was my first thought after my first fight with me.
Yeah, and you flew through the pros initially, low two dozen fights undefeated, and got good sponsorship and a nice strong following straight off the bat. But I think you've mentioned in the past that it was more issues outside of the ring. Maybe you enjoyed the social side of things and had a bit of an addictive personality. Can you remember the point where you made a decision with yourself that you were going to park all that stuff and just focus on matters in the ring?
Yeah, well, so it was... originally when I got there, I had started to research nutrition a lot too. So I actually started that before I went to Australia. So I started to... for the first time in my life, I was living by myself. I started cooking for myself. And so I started to trial out all the stuff I was researching. And I started to make good headway with making proper meals for myself and seeing how much carbohydrate I needed and protein I needed and fat and what that was doing and hormone-wise. And so it was very good learning all that stuff. But then at the same time, I couldn't get down the last bit of weight as well. So... I remember, you know, without going too much into detail about all the logistics and the whole story, but I remember, you know, I needed to stop drinking as well. So I was doing all the right stuff, but I was still drinking. So, still drinking quite a bit. And so eventually, you know, after my grandfather had died, you know, he had said to me, he said, you know, give up that drink some and give this everything you've got. And I knew I was giving it everything I've got in other ways, but just not with alcohol. You know, I knew that was something that I could give away that was going to help me. So eventually when he passed away and I had a draw in my third fight, you know, finally the penny dropped for me after many, many years of partying and that. So I gave it away. I gave it up. And the funny thing about it was, that was my last fight at light heavyweight. Within a very short time, I had dropped down to super middle. I won the super middleweight championship, and then I went down to middleweight, all within the same year of 2011. So it's crazy how quick my weight dropped, and I got down and became a lot more healthy. And then starting 2012, I started on a good run. I was obviously not drinking, I was doing everything right, and then I had a good win at the start of the year, and then I had that win for me, that Queensland middleweight title win, the TKO against the great fighter Nathan Carroll. So after that point, I just seen, whoa, I'm really making momentum here. So after that, then, you know, that was the majority of stuff, you know, not drinking, eating well. And then it was about getting the little percenters in. So then I started to look at what I can do, you know, and obviously then for recovery and all these other little things and better sleep and everything else. So, to this day, I mean, we're 8 years on. I'm still learning new stuff of how to keep the body in better state. So, you know, I've got a strength coach, Christopher Muckers, who does a lot of recovery with me. And, you know, we're still learning stuff on a daily basis. Obviously, ice bath, you know, breathing, you know, trigger points in the body to release certain areas. And, you know, it's just you never stop learning in this game. And I don't want to hear it. You know, keep expanding the knowledge will only keep me in better state.
Yeah, and you've been a big advocate of the power of the mind as well, Dennis, and you've spoken before about meditation and the law of attraction and these kind of things. I've seen you do speaking engagements in Australia on these kind of subjects. Are these still very important parts of your day-to-day preparation?
Yeah, like massive for me. And so, like, I'm so, you know, the funny thing about it is, you know, people will ask me, you know, you're going to Mexico, you know, this, that, or the other, and I'm like, but you know what? I've envisioned being world champion, and I said I would do whatever it takes to get here. And I keep my mind right, I keep my body right, and I've seen it and felt it for so long. I just believe that, you know, I knew there was going to be a big story to tell at the end of my career, and that's why I think that this is all matching in. What bigger story than to go down to Mexico and win the world championship? So, the belief that's got me to where I am today, the belief and everything I've been doing, I believe is the exact ingredient that's going to get me over the line and get me that win in Mexico. I look at what I do. You know, I don't say to myself, you know, you have to meditate every day, but I will always monitor how I'm feeling. And if I'm not feeling balanced and I'm not feeling that certainty that I usually feel, and I'm not feeling that belief or clarity, which can only just be a little bit of just being off center a little bit or just being out of whack, just that's when I narrow back down on my meditation and everything else, and narrow in. You know, I do read my mission statement, my goals every day, and that inspires me and gives me those good feelings that helps me, keeps me inspired and motivated. But you know, the truth of it is, I do the hard work anyway because it's in grinding. I grind it out anyway. It's in me. It's just there. But just keeping your mind right and keeping your mind focused and all that, you know, all that stuff plays into it. I do spend time every day visualizing that, and you know what, I enjoy doing it. I enjoy thinking about the stuff I can do better and visualizing doing those things better, and you know, visualizing how I want tomorrow to work out. I don't just visualize what I have to do, I visualize doing well, you know. Like, so last night I've got a big spar with 2 to 3 opponents coming in fresh, so I visualise, you know, getting in and doing, ticking all the boxes in terms of our game plan and being intense for the first few minutes of every round and recovering well in between, and all the tiny little details that I want to go well today. I've already visualised that last night, and I visualised feeling good about it, how well it went. And sure enough, I'll feel that by the end of the day. So I have two little tactics like that I use on a daily basis, and it's made me who I am today.
Yeah, and in terms of your family life, Dennis, you've been in Australia a long time now. You're well established over there. But I'm sure the Irish roots are still a big part of your life. Like, how important is it that your daughter grows up knowing that she's Irish as well?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, she's Irish through and through anyway. You can see it in her. She's very like me, you know, which I think that's maybe why I see the Irish in cinema. Heritage is obviously a great thing, and I love that I grew up in Ireland. You know, I love going back to Ireland. I'm going to go back to Ireland after the title fight and see my family and that. And you know, there's nowhere else I would have rather grown up, to be honest. It's made me who I am, and I'm quite happy with who I am, and that's something that I you know, I had to learn to do, but. But I mean, in terms of like it is a bit tougher in Ireland with the weather and stuff like that. So I do believe that we have to learn how to override that and just be happy in ourselves, regardless of what the weather is or regardless of what's going on. With the government or with financially around the country, you have to learn to be happy in yourself. And I think Ireland's been really good, to help me with that. And so, it's obviously a nation of fighters. I do believe Australia is also, but I know a lot more about Irish history and what happened. And we are a nation of fighters and warriors, and we don't give up. We keep pushing forward. And what I want to show Aria is that in me. And so she'll obviously see that in me. She'll see that in my career and everything I do on a daily basis. But when she's old enough to understand it and see it, I really want her to be able to see that in herself as well. And she'll know her history. And it'll be good for sure.
Yeah, and citizenship is obviously, it's a big thing over here at the moment and probably over there as well. But I'm just wondering, I read something about your dual Australian-Irish flag and you've removed the Union Jack from that. Can you just tell me a little bit about your decision-making process behind that?
Yeah, look, we did the flag back in 2012, the half-and-half flag, and we didn't have the Union Jack in it. But, I mean, it's like I said to the media in Australia, it's just, I don't represent the Union Jack. I don't live in the United Kingdom. And out of respect to the fallen comrades of Ireland as well, and all the history in Ireland, but I mean, the general thing is we live in Australia. It's the Southern Cross looks over Australia, and what I believe Australia is a cool place, man. Like it's for me, I believe it's a land of opportunity. And that part of the flag represents that for me, and coming, integrating into Australia and Australian values. And I think that's what Australia is all about. It's about, a multicultural place that's integrating Australian values and people getting on and working together and peace. And so that's what I wanted to represent, and that's what I believe it represents, and I want to represent that flag. So,
yeah. And just moving back to the boxing side of things, you've had most of your career in Australia, and it's a path that a lot of Irish boxers have taken over the years. TJ Dohany, most memorably, came from there, won his world title. Can you just tell me a bit about the Australian boxing scene itself? Is it a tough place to make your way?
Well, I'll tell you first, but the Australian domestic scene is, and I've said this from day one, it's like, those guys are tough as nails. it hasn't really reflected it yet on the domestic scene. I mean, you have your Jeff Horn, Daniel Gills, all those guys, world champions there, Mundine and all, but in terms of getting there and seeing how, like, there's three or four shows nearly every weekend and it's within driving distance. And you can always get great spars. The guys are tough. I mean, even the amateurs that are fighting on the amateur scene, obviously, they're all sparring six rounds, so they're all made for the pro game, I believe. And it doesn't get enough credit. Where I believe, it doesn't show on the world stage is, I think, because usually we kind of usually get, sent out as opponents for world championship fights. There's so many Australians that have been in world championship fights, and you don't need to win, but so many have lost, and it just seems that that maybe in my, my belief in it, and there's no disrespect to anybody, is that maybe those couple of, those top 15 fights that you probably need to build yourself up probably haven't been there. And then, the world title fight gets introduced a couple of fights too early, and then obviously you have the champion's home soil, and that fighter may not be ready for them. And that's what I believe, there might have been, that's what I believe, it obviously failed a little bit. And I feel like I can talk about that also because, I sort of did that with Jack Cloquet out in Germany. I feel like there was about two fights I probably should have had in between that to go over there supremely confident. We didn't do that. Now, there was obviously another matter that played into that as well. But I think the positive of all that is, the guys over there, they're tough as nails. There's great sparring going on. There's great fights every weekend. And I just think now that, you know, obviously get the right fights and, you know, there can be a lot of Australian world champions right now at this exact moment. I believe there's about 10 world champions right there right now that I can think of offhand.
Right. And just, you mentioned the Kulkay fight there, Dennis. I'm sure it was a bitter pill to swallow at the time, but it must be something you're able to draw upon now as a bit of a learning experience and something you're going to use as a tool going into this next world title fight.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the last time I was on Off the Ball, I was talking to Andy, and Andy kind of said, and what I said to Andy was, I said, yeah, like, you know, to have a saying, you know, over in Australia, that's, you've got to be in the grand final before you know how to win one. But for me, it's quite similar with the types of the title fight because, you know, for me, obviously, I'm a lot more technical than everything else, but at the end of that fight, I still was fine. I still had lots of energy. And what I learned was, after that, was, you get in there, you get your foot on your opponent's throat and you keep it there. You know, you don't give him anything. And so that's what one of the key points that I learned from that fight. I had so much more to give by the time that fight had gone. And like, you know, you don't want to be walking out of a world title fight without giving everything. So, I mean, if I had given everything I had, you know, it might have been different. But obviously I didn't have the skills I have now. And now I'm obviously more confident, and I know I can do a lot more, and I know a lot more about people's styles and how to counteract that. But you give a place that with that, you know, with the skills and ability, you place that with my confidence levels, you place that with the team I have around me, place that with that, you know, that keep your foot on the throat and don't let up. And I think that's a great learning curve from that last loss.
Yeah, and from a training point of view, you mentioned the team you have around you. You're with Glenn Rushton now, but you would have spent a bit of time in the world-famous Miami Fifth Street gym. What was that experience like? Did you pick up anything over there?
Well, actually, I did spar down in the Fifth Street gym, and they're very, very close, all the boxing trainers and fighters. We all sparred around with each other. Mm. We go to different gyms, so I was actually part of Moro's gym, Moro Fernandez, but... Yeah. But yes, look, being around all those guys in Spain and there, it was a learning curve, wasn't it? It was good. I tell you, I mean, one of the main things that I've learned was that I have a faster, more explosive work rate than most fighters, and I think that's what I tend to see over and over and over again. And I mean, it's good to know that I have that because. You know, because I know that, you know, I'll be fit enough for any fight that I get into. So then what I did then was, knowing that I'm like this, it was good to be able to sit back and focus in more on my skills and my abilities and put more, you know, kind of more intelligence to the boxing. And then obviously we keep working that intelligence with the skills and stuff and everything else as you up your intensity. And it just seems to all come together beautifully. So... Every single round of sparring has been beneficial, and it's been very beneficial being over in Miami for sure. Yeah.
And as I mentioned, you've linked up with Glenn now, and he's probably most famous for masterminding that Jeff Horn win over Manny Pacquiao. How would you describe Glenn as a coach, Dennis?
Yeah, Glenn is a phenomenal coach. His attention to detail has been like anything I've never seen before. When he makes for the skills and that and for doing all of your, you know, to become a better fighter, he breaks it down and breaks it down and breaks it down till it's very, you know, most bare, and then you completely understand it and say, but you don't just understand it for what it is, and you start to do it and you do it and then you bring it all back together. Mm. And then it's fully ingrained in you, and so you go over all of that. We went over that for many, many months. When I first went with Glenn, and he's seen everything that he said that he needed to see that I could do. Now it's a matter of being able to integrate that whenever we needed to, and bring it all together. So, and I worked very hard, like 5 to 6 hours a day for the first 4 to 5 months to integrate all of that and make it part of me. And then now it's about obviously game plans, and obviously Glenn is a very intelligent man with it. A strangely high IQ, and he works out game plans on fighters. And so he has between a 6 and a 10 point plan.
Yeah.
And you stick to those, and you're guaranteed a win, I believe. So we work out brilliant game plans, and so we just you know, obviously going back to the corner, the way he's able to speak to me, the way he knows each fighter, and it's a real calm, relaxing feeling, and it just you just go back after every round, and I just seem to do everything he's saying. So it's constant, but it's good, and obviously it's adding a lot more to my confidence level.
Yeah. And in terms of the Munguia fight, I know you're going into this one as a bit of an underdog as far as the bookies are concerned, but so was Horn when he fought Pacquiao that time. So that must serve as a bit of an inspiration for you, someone you're close to like that, pulling off a big upset, you know, in the same sort of circumstances.
Yeah, well, like that's it. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, my goal, first off, was to be world champion, right? And then when I seen something like I'm being a part of the likes of Jeff beating Manny Pacquiao, beating an absolute legend of the game.
Yeah.
And I've seen the ramifications of that in a good way and what it's done for his career and his brand. Then I thought to myself, I wasn't thinking about just being world champion anymore. I was thinking, you know, I want to beat someone of you know, that's when I won a world championship, I want to feel what that's like, you know. And I kind of did, but it felt good. I could see Jeff and what I'd done for him, and I went, that'll be the way to do it. And so I think maybe that brought that into my consciousness, and now here we are going to Mexico to fight a superstar. But again, I do believe it's playing into everything that I've really been visualising, and you know, my goals for my brand and everything else. So it's kind of, this is exactly what it is now, and it doesn't get much bigger than this, and it could be the exact same thing as, you know, what went on for Horn. So great to have that and see it, and great to be around that vibe. And, you know, with all the media I'm doing at the minute, you know, seeing Jeff having to go through that before the Jeff Horn fight, and then before the Crawford fight and everything else, and how strenuous that can be, it just kind of, it brought it into my mind, you know, okay, well, this is what we've got to deal with now before my world title fight and then after this and everything else. So it's kind of cool to be able to see him doing everything one step before me. And seeing how he deals with stuff and everything else, you know, Jeff is just a brilliant human, a brilliant boxer, and it's great to be around that, you know, and it's a great vibe in the gym.
Yeah, and you mentioned Munguia as a superstar, and he certainly is one of the more highly touted fighters in the game at the moment. He really burst onto the scene when he beat Saddam Ali. I think you were there for that one. What were your first impressions of him, Dennis?
Well, my first impression straight up was you know, okay, Saddam is a very small welterweight. That's what I was thinking going in there. And then when I seen him, I thought, oh, he looks big. he's probably like a middleweight. And I knew that he was looking to fight the Loftin. So I knew that he was definitely a strong middleweight, at least. You know, maybe even a super middleweight, who knows. But then, you know, so I was thinking, well, this seems like a bit of a mismatch in terms of that. But again, Saddam was a good boxer in Colorado. So we said, yeah, it's interesting. It was very interesting. One thing I noticed about it was before he came out, we would show clips of him in the change room. And he was happy. You know, he was smiling. He was doing pads. He was happy. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of myself. And I went, you know, because I do believe a happy fighter is a dangerous fighter. And he was smiling and that, but he was working, and I knew he was focused, but he was still enjoying it. And the reason why I noticed that, as I said, was because it reminded me of myself. And then when he came out and did what he did, you know, he knocked Saddam down twice in the first round, got him out there in the fourth, and burst onto the scenes, I thought to myself, you know, this is, you know, obviously I do believe, you know, a proper super welterweight would give him trouble, but I'd be able to, you know, obviously counteract that. But at the same time, you know, I feel like I'd be the same as him in terms of mindset as well. So I'd bring a lot more experience to the game. I've had a lot more experience. I know he's had more fights, but he's had, you know, 28 of those were knockouts. So I've gone at least 10 round fights and 12 round fights. So all that experience I have, I just know that can make the difference. So it didn't really faze me at all. I knew it was giving me a different trajectory, but it didn't really faze me at all. And now here we are, not even a year later, he has three title defense so far, which is, I believe, probably unheard of. But But yeah, it's good. I mean, there's all these factors that I don't really look at. I don't really care that much because I fully believe in our own plan. But I do think that, you know, you're backing up fights that quick as well. You know, something's got to give. I told him the last one, something was giving a bit.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't look that good. He didn't look that strong. So, you know, and then I thought to myself, right, logically, if I had a performance like that, what would I do? Well, I'd definitely be needing a while off anyway. We'll come back, recuperate, get strong, refresh. And then all of a sudden, we're on April 13th in Mexico. So this might, like, this may not, this could be bad for him, very bad. But not to worry anyway, we'll see how it goes. I'm confident of getting the win, even if he's at his best. So it doesn't really matter. But I just didn't think it was smart, that's all. Not from my own perspective.
Yeah. And size is something you cited there. It's obviously a big factor. He's huge for 154 pounds. There's already been talk of him moving up to middleweight and chat about a possible Canelo fight down the line, given the Golden Boy link up there. Are you expecting size to be a factor, Dennis, or has your game plan obviously accounted for all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the best fights I've fought against taller guys. Me being a light heavyweight for years, obviously, I actually learned how to box those taller guys better. I believe they've got bigger target areas. I like to mix head, body, head as well too. So having more of a target area on the body and mixing up to the head gives me, you know, obviously more stuff to do. It makes me more elusive as well in terms of what I'm going to do and how varied I am in my combinations and shots. So this, it was good. So for me, in terms of size, I would rather fight Munguia as big as he is than Saddam Ali, as small as he is. And that's the truth of it. If you look at Kurt K, he was much smaller than me, and he was my only loss. So I have fought smaller fighters like Reach and that, and I've done well against them. But I do believe that I feel a lot more confident and varied with what I control with the taller fighters. And I can make myself smaller as well. So when I get in, I can make myself smaller than that. I'll cause a lot more problems. So I'm glad. I'm glad he is what he is, and I'm feeling good about what size he is too.
Yeah, as I alluded to there, there is some talk, not necessarily from Munguia because he's focused on the fight, but people around him are sort of chatting about middleweight prospects and fight with Canelo. Is there a sense that they're overlooking you, Dennis? And do you care even?
Yeah. Well, look. I mean, I was in an international conference call yesterday with Munguia on the line and his trainer and Golden Boy and all. And a lot of the questions were shot towards Munguia fighting Canelo and fighting, you know, Charlo and Harrison and all that. And someone came on and said, you know, do you feel disrespected that, you know, you're being talked over? But, I mean, those questions are flying at him from media sources. And everything else, you know. He said himself he's focused on me.
Yeah.
Which I know he is, to be honest. Like, you know, you have to be. If you're a proper professional, you are focused on your fight at hand. You know, but you can always be about the bigger picture. I'm about the bigger picture. You know, obviously, I don't know if you're going to ask me about it next, but...
it's coming, all right.
Michael Sullivan in the three arenas.
Yeah.
I mean, the three arenas for a homecoming is on my mind. Certainly doesn't mean I'm overlooking Munguia. I'm not, but no, I don't feel like disrespected by that in any way, because this is a business.
Yeah,
and everybody's always looking to see what the biggest fights are, where the biggest money is, and just like Munguia was a year ago, I'm looking to burst onto the scenes and become world champion. So, you know who, you know, when we, myself and Paul Keegan from DDP Sports sat down with Eric Gomez before that fight, we asked, what would Saddam Ali do next? Would he come to Australia? And, you know, and sort of we spoke about what he wanted to do next and everything else. But yet Munguia was on the way up. Now they're asking Munguia, what do you want to do next? And I'm on the way up. So I just see it for what it is, and I don't put any energy towards it whatsoever.
Yeah, and you mentioned Paul Keegan there. It's obviously great to have people like that around you. I know boxing can be a tricky business at times, but Golden Boy have also suggested, you know, they'd like to keep working with you, whatever happens going forward. And Spike O'Sullivan obviously has a bit of a link up with them already. You've mentioned it yourself. That's obviously a fight you're going to be interested in going forward, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I'll say now, I met Spike before, I sparred with him, and I really like Spike, and I've been following him ever since we sparred back in 2015.
Yeah.
Paddy Collins and all the boys there, you know, major respect for the whole lot of them. But, you know, my dream leaving Australia 2011 was win the World Championship, come back and defend it. And that's been the dream all along. And I've seen that and I visualise that every single day.
Yeah.
Since that. I mean, I was even talking about how much I visualised it back in 2012 on an article with John McNally from the Kildare Nationalists. But
yeah.
So now it turns, obviously now it's Spike down the super welterweight. We can make history. Two Irish fellas fighting for a world championship in Ireland. And I just think, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. Spike's a big seller as well. Mm. He gives a massive following. And I think that can just fit in perfectly for a brilliant summer evening late 2018. So, 2019. So, who knows? I mean, I'm certainly gearing for it. So, hopefully we can make it happen.
Yeah, it'd be great. And what were the spars like, Dennis?
Yeah, good spars. I mean, sparring is sparring. So,
yeah.
It is what it is, but he's a tough fella, and I seen him sparring with a few other fellas too. But look, Spike is tough as nails, and he deserves all the success he has. I know he'll bring a great fight, and I know myself and Spike will bring a great fight to the Irish public and for everyone watching as well around the world. It will be great, but for Ireland especially, to have that fight in Ireland, I just think that would be great. And that obviously cements me and Spike as well, also in Irish history too. So, I'd love to be a part of that. And yeah, I'd say Spike is too.
And just the last point on the Mungia fight, which is the task at hand. We've spoken about visualisation already. Have you already visualised this hostile atmosphere, Dennis, and walking away with the belt afterwards?
Yeah, we'll have a session there for sure. That will be very vocal in that, I believe. So that would be cool. But yeah, I visualise the whole lot. I have it all down, every single part of it. So, I mean, those things don't have to work out exactly as you visualise it. Some things can work out better. You know, you leave a little bit up to mystery, which can work out in a better way as well. But yeah, it's probably not going to be great. We'll just get the belt and get out of there quick.
Great stuff, Dennis. Thanks a million for taking the call. All the best with the fight and enjoy all the build-up. It's going to be great and hopefully we'll chat to you afterwards. Dennis Hogan there, who's getting set for the chance of a lifetime against Jaime Munguia, and he won't mind me saying, as I said at the start, he's a huge underdog, but in some ways that can be a benefit. You can use the sort of underdog status in your favour and, you know, maybe catch them by surprise.
Yeah, like this could be Munguia's, probably going to be his last fight at light middleweight. Maybe he's looking beyond Dennis Hogan. But like your first world title fight, you couldn't pick tougher conditions, tougher opponents. I think, like we were talking earlier about big upsets, like this would be thrown straight into it if Dennis Hogan somehow manages to get a win, because he's fighting a guy that has an unbelievable knockout ratio, 83%. Hogan doesn't knock people out. How is he going to discourage Munguia from coming forward with the relentless pace that he fights at? You know, everything points towards Munguia stopping him. So, I don't know, like, it's Masters Week, so if we're going to use a golf analogy and say, like, you know, par, like, what is par for Dennis Hogan in this? Like, is it going 6 or 7 rounds? If he went 12 rounds and put in a really good performance, does he get another chance at a world title shot? Like we talked a few weeks about, John O'Carroll didn't beat Tevin Farmer, but he impressed in defeat, so he'd probably get another world title shot.
Mm.
That's maybe what Dennis Hogan can achieve this weekend.
Mm.
He's given up advantages in weight, height, reach. He's the away fighter as well, going into Munguia's backyard. Munguia has one of the most vicious left hooks I've ever seen. It's like he pivots his whole body into it, and it looks like in slow motion you'd see it coming a mile away, but he just throws it so fast, and he has his right hand held high so he can't even clip him, as he's not even exposed and he's throwing it. So I can't see it going past the 7th round.
Like, if you're talking hypotheticals, and we were trying to conjure up some positive energy at the start of the show, talking about upsets and maybe hoping Dennis and Anthony can pull off the upsets, but like hypotheticals, he has fought at light heavyweight before, Dennis, so he's used to fighting bigger guys. Mm. He's come all the way down to light middle now, so that won't daunt him at all. And you say Munguia might be overlooking him. He's 100% overlooking him.
Yeah.
There's talk of Canelo at the end of the year.
Yeah, he's talking about Canelo
moving up.
Golovkin, they seem to be trying to maybe match him with Demetrius Andrade because it'd probably be the easier of the middleweight champions. But even Munguia's gone, nah, I want Golovkin or Canelo.
Mm.
Okay, he's going to look past him, but it's also his first defence on home soil.
Yeah, there's pressure there.
So he has to go in and impress. So I can, like, maybe he might be looking past, but I think he's that good that he can look past.
He's also straddling that line. Like, we know how fit Dennis Hogan is. He could fight 15 rounds, but Munguia is straddling that line between a huge light middleweight and too big for the weight, where it's actually a disadvantage to be coming all the way down. And that's borne out over a century of boxing where it's one fight too many, and he probably should be at middleweight already.
Yeah, he's huge. He's for the weight, he's a monster. And the weight cut is possibly the only, but even still, he's going to, unfortunately, I think he's going to blast Hogan out of it. He's just too big. He is strong.
Yeah, and if
we're sitting here next week going, that will be one of the biggest, possibly in the top three biggest upsets in boxing history if Hogan pulls itself.
And Munguia is still such a novice in the game.
He's
novice
22.
In age terms.
Yeah.
Like, he's blown some top level operators just out of the water entirely. So Dennis is mixing it in that sort of level.
Yeah, we're going to find out what Dennis Hogan's chin is really like. He is so durable, but this is just, Munguia is just a different beast altogether. But it's, do you know what? It's great for Dennis Hogan. He's worked so hard to get this title shot. Nobody can take that away from him. It's the biggest stage. When the fight is finished, he'll know where he is. Like, so, if he does go the distance, he'll take great confidence from that.
Mm. Simon, who's got a better chance this weekend, Dennis Hogan or Anthony Crawler?
Crawler, because I don't think there's a far more likelihood that Hogan's going to get stopped.
Simon or Phil?
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think, bizarrely, I think Crawler, if you can say, he has an easier task than Hogan, but it's like, I think they're both not quite Mission Impossible, but almost.
And if you were Joe Gallagher, and I know you've mentioned to me yesterday just tactically how you're going to approach this, if you were in his corner, is there any little intricacies you might be encouraging him to do, or how do you even approach a fight against an alien?
I don't know, because the problem is Lomachenko wants to counter punch, so you can say, all right, let's not play to his strengths. But then if you try and go toe-to-toe with him, he'll just rip you apart with body shots. So
try and hit him in the face, I suppose, would be the easiest.
Yeah, good luck with that. I know Linares dropped him, but it was a flash knockdown. It wasn't. And then he actually finishes Linares with a body shot. You can study all the tapes you want if you're Joe Gallagher and if you're Anthony Crawler, and you can be sitting ringside watching him and you think you know what he's all about, but it's not going to be till the first bell rings and then you go to try and close him down, or you can't hit him. And it's just what has happened so many elite fighters against Lomachenko is they just lose heart and they retire. Rigondo just got pissed off after a few rounds, and he just, Rigondo's had his critics, but he's an elite fighter. And Lomachenko just made such a mockery of him that Rigondo's I need to get out of here. I don't think Crawler will do that, though. He won't feel sorry for himself. He'll think, I'm gonna give this my best shot. And he's had an incredible career. And if he was to go out losing to Lomachenko, that wouldn't be a bad way to.
If anyone's story would suggest they're capable of pulling off the impossible, it's Anthony Crawler as well. What he's come back from in and out of the ring.
Yeah, and if he does, then if you're a Hollywood director, you're all over it.
You nearly have to make one movie about him winning the world title, and then part two is the
all the setbacks, outside the ring, then the defeats to Gary Sykes, prize fighter. cancelled fights. I just think it's just going to be almost undoable.
He's not going to out-jab him. He's not going to out-move him. He's not going to out-punch him. So just sitting here thinking, the only way he might do it is if he just left hooked to the liver.
Imagine.
Just walks him with one hand over this side of the face and just tries to left hook to the liver. I'll fight. And if he lands the money shot, that's how I think he wins.
Like, levels within boxing, it's something that comes up a lot, but there's levels within levels, and like Crawley fought Linares and got relatively outclassed, especially in the second fight.
And Linares is classed.
Yeah, and Linares ultimately outclassed by Lomachenko, so that's just kind of puts things in perspective a bit. But then Barry from Barnes League will come into Crawley and say you have no right to be in the ring with Lomachenko, but Crawley's a world champion.
Yeah.
He's mixed it with the best. This is the third time he's fought for the Ring magazine belt. He's going to fight for the pound for pound number one spot as well. So it's a pretty remarkable thing.
Oh well, there's no, like, he deserves the shot. It's just the fact that Lomachenko's just the best fighter on the planet by a long, long stretch. It's just he just unfortunately for Crawley happens to be in the same weight category as him. Mm. But no, he without a doubt deserves his title shot.
In terms of who has a better chance, the only thing I would say against Anthony is that if you're comparing Lomachenko and Munguia, Lomachenko's in a different stratosphere to what Munguia is bringing to the table.
Yeah, but he hasn't got the explosive power that Munguia has. Like, he's powerful.
He doesn't have the brutal stoppage power that Munguia has, and that's why, I picked Crawley.
I think his combination punching's obviously infinitely better, so if he gets Crawley in trouble, he's going to put him away, I would say. Whereas Munguia could get frustrated. And while you can probably build a case for Hogan, there's holes in Munguia's game. There's no holes in Lomachenko's game.
No, like, that's it. I know, listening to what Joe Gallagher said, like, there is, every fighter has chinks in their armour. But, you know, you'd be looking at Lomachenko and you'd have to rewind and go, is that one there? Like, he's flawless, and it's great that we get to see him again Friday night. Mm. And if you're Anthony Crawley, just enjoy it. Just you get to share the ring with one of the best fighters and enjoy it. And said, I can see Hogan being stopped. Crawley has probably got a better chance of going further, but I don't think, again, it won't go at a distance. I think just the combinations, the referee could just step in and just say, look, you've had enough. But it won't be brutal.
Oh, we'll see. I'm certainly looking forward to it. And just the last point, we can get to any other business, lads, if you have it. But one last point on these fights. We did our pound for pound rankings a couple of months ago, and it's Lomachenko and Terence Crawford 1 and 2. Does this month, can that this month alter things at all?
At least you, Ronald Mullen, pound for pound rankings. I think I had Usyk at number 2.
Ah, well, you know, he hasn't fought since, so we'll just...
Usyk's fighting.
Takam,
yeah.
His heavyweight debut.
It's a nice debut at heavyweight.
We had talked about that, actually. He was a good opponent for Usyk to come in at heavyweight.
The ultimate gatekeeper.
I don't see how Crawford jumps ahead of Usyk when he fought a guy who just come back from a gunshot wound in his leg.
Yeah, but like what he's done in other divisions, you know. But he's conquered 3 divisions.
So Ronan Mullen's pound for pound list.
Well, in my pound for pound list, I think yours as well, Phil.
So long ago, I can't even remember.
Does this month alter things? Like, do wins over Amir Khan and Anthony Crawley change things in any way?
No, if Crawford beats Khan and Lomachenko beats Crawley, like, Lomachenko's still ahead. I think I had Usyk number 2.
You did, yeah.
As well. So
that's why I called him up on it.
Yeah, so I think if Usyk beat, well, when or if he beats Takam, then, you know, he's gonna keep his place.
If I remember correctly, I had Errol Spence ahead of Crawford
Well, I think Andy Lee has those two as his top 2, so that's probably why it was in my mind. But
if Andy's not here, Ronan.
It's tough for the two lads because the defining fights that can put them into all-time greatness are on the other side of the street, really. Mm. So they're going to be stuck fighting your Anthony Crawleys and your Amir Khans for a long time yet.
Well, Crawford, once he beats Khan, he's out of opponents. They have to make a deal.
Yeah.
Promotional deal with PBC.
I'd say Danny Garcia is probably the most likely. They could probably coax him over.
He's not the same. No. Garcia, he's not as good as he was. I know Andy referenced it before, he doesn't know if he...
Hunger.
The hunger seems to have gone, you know, he's he's got all the money now. He can buy all the leopard skin stuff that he wants, leopard print.
And we're waiting to see what Keith Thurman's sitting idle at the moment. Manny Pacquiao sitting idle, and then you have the winner, Errol Spence, is sitting idle. So I think everyone's just waiting to see what happens with this Crawford Khan thing.
I'm looking forward to, we'll get into that fight. There's actually a nice tactical battle there. If a prime Amir Khan turns up, it might actually be an entertaining fight. So just last couple of points, you mentioned Usyk against Takam. It's great to see him in the heavyweight mix. Do you think he's in heavyweight for the long term, or is he just testing the waters, dipping his toe in?
I might say he's in it for the long term. He's done all he can at cruiserweight. He's beaten all his rivals, and I'd say he's been using his time out of the ring to put on a bit of weight, do it the right way. And yeah, Takam's a decent opponent for him, because you can Takam has fought the other.
It's a massive test, isn't it?
Exactly. So we'd see what he's like. He'd be too good for Takam in terms of his boxing ability. And what's going to happen if he does eventually go on to fight any of the big three, people are going to question whether Usyk has enough power to trouble them, and can he take the biggest punches from the biggest heavyweights. But they mightn't be able to hit him.
I was dying to see him getting thrown in the deep end against Povetkin. I would have loved to see him.
That would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
Maybe that could happen after.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the plan. Any last nuggets for the Off the Brawl audience, Simon?
No, just excited to see Usyk back, you know. I mean, we were kind of waiting and waiting and waiting, and now it's announced and we're good to go. And I want to see how his speed and movement at the higher weight, how much he's carrying actually extra into this fight, and then quite possibly down how much he adds going into the one after that. I'd say it'll be two fights before he challenges one of the big three.
Are you more excited for Usyk or Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones.
Get out.
That's not good enough.
No, there's only six more episodes left of Game of Thrones.
There'll be
10 more fights with Usyk. So.
Well, we'll see what happens with Usyk. That's May, isn't it? Middle of May?
Yeah.
So we've got a bit of time to preview that one, and the heavyweight mix is really going to kick up a notch around that time as well. We'll get to all that and more on next week's episode of Off the Brawl. Thanks for coming in, lads.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for tuning in as always. We'll chat to you next week.